So I guess we'd say we're at 401 Richmond, and now we're going to walk to Spadina, or at the corner. And I guess
you should introduce yourselves too.
Oh yeah, so it's Michael McClelland and Philip Evans from ERE Architects, and I think we're going to try and talk a lot about history, because then through history you can kind of observe how a place has changed and evolved over time.
Sounds great.
So if we stop here, right at the corner of Richmond and Spadina, you see that Spadina is an extra big street, extra wide street, and that goes right to the kind of early history of why the city got developed the way it did. So the family that owned the huge chunk of this neighborhood was the Baldwin family, and they built a house way at the top of the hill up by Casa Loma called Spadina, the Spadina house, and all of Spadina was laid out so that they had a nice grand view down to the lake from their country house. And they had an idea. They were a very forward-looking family. The Robert Baldwin set up the whole idea of responsible government in Canada. And so they had an idea Toronto was going to be a grand place. So they set up Spadina, you can call it either, as a grand avenue, because that's their anticipation of what the city was going to be. But really the way the city got set up was very ad hoc. And so you see the way 401 Richmond has no sidewalk. That's related to the fact that the streets running east-west were never planned properly. And when the city was called the New Town, which is the new city, it only went as far as Peter Street. It just, the city limits were Peter Street. The city limits were Peter Street because that's how far you could shoot a cannon from Fort York. And so the cannons, so everything that's this side of Peter Street stayed as something called the Military Reserve. And if you walk around this area, you actually see planned, we can stop here for a second. If you actually see this area, you can actually find things that are related to the military planning. So they decided they'd make interesting parks. And so Victoria Square, Clarence Square are all part of that military plan to make a really spectacular residential neighborhood in this area. We just stopped at this one building that's getting renovated. It's just between Richmond and Queen on the west side. And it looks like, it's 163-ish. It looks like a regular commercial building on this side. But if you look around the side, you see it was once a church. It was called St. Anne's Church. And if you look at the back, you can see a brick belfry and big arched windows.
Right.
So you get the idea that this neighborhood changed from, first of all, a residential neighborhood. Then the railways came kind of close. A lot of the residential moved out, and things became factories. And so you get these kind of small factories because they're all built on residential lots. So it's all these residential lots that are here that make the uses. And along with residences, there were churches. There are other things. You find remnants of them all over the city, but this St. I'm sure it was called St. Anne's, is one example that in the 1920s was changed. And Spadina itself went from being residential to being really the place for all the needle trade, all the industry related to the needle trade. And so you have fantastic history on Spadina about unions, the Jewish community that was set up Kensington Market, and you have people like Emma Goldman, a very famous anarchist who had to escape from the States, and she spent time in Toronto because she tried to blow up somebody in the States, and very important cultural history related to that kind of industry and the social goals that were developed by unions. Blah, 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 blah. Is this okay?
Yeah, this is terrific. Just a question about the sight line. Would the one Spadina Crescent building have been a later development then, in that original plan to see straight down?
No, one Spadina, the Crescent, was actually laid out as a garden plan so that it would be a nice garden that they would see as part of the view, and then eventually that was taken over by the university. And if you turn on Spadina, you get what the Baldwin family, they owned. This, the way the city worked until quite late in the 19th century was that the city limits were Queen Street, was the north limit, and above that were all of these lots called park lots. And the Baldwin family owned one of these big park lots. They owned land from Queen Street to Bloor. And you can check that right now. There's things like the sidewalk on the north side of Queen is extra wide, and it goes as far as the Baldwin's property. And then it stops with that one building you see down there where all of a sudden the building on the north side comes into the sidewalk. That's the end of the Baldwin's property. So they planned everything to be big and grand. They were thinking Paris.
Plus.
Philip? We'll think of other stuff to say.
What's that?
We'll think of this. So when you look at these buildings, you look at the buildings, like you just were in kind of the shopping part of Queen Street. This has moved from being...
So I guess we should say we've headed east.
We're heading east, and we're...
On the south side of Queen Street.
Heading east on the south side of Queen Street. We're passing things like Club Monaco. And this is a kind of area of where you can see kind of waves of development that happen in an area. This used to be a very cool, very interesting area. It's become less cool because of the moving in of more generic stores, but that's simply the way neighborhoods work. When it's cheap, artists live there, they make it interesting, and then they get bought out.
I think it was, I think Le Chateau was the first one that kind of moved in, and that from that point there, it became...
It was downhill?
Downhill.
But there have been fantastic places here, so the Bamboo Club was great for a long time.
Where was that?
That was right... Where it was back in there, which is now called Ultra, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. The Peter Pan has been here forever. I think it was the first. It was here in the 1970s.
That's a pretty striking brick.
Yeah.
Building there that Peter Pan's in.
Well, actually, if you look at the buildings. You can guess the age of the buildings range everywhere from 1860s, maybe some 1850s buildings, a lot of 1890s buildings. Like the Peter Pan building is pretty much late Victorian, like 1890s or so. And you can look and actually see, you can see terracotta details on the building, you can see stone details on the building, and really nice brickwork. And the brickwork probably came from the Don Valley Brickworks, which is now evergreen. There's the Black Bull. A lot of the pubs in the city say they're the oldest pub in the city. It doesn't mean that they are. It means that maybe there was a pub there earlier. But the Black Bull, as a building, is probably about 1870s or so.
How would you determine that?
Stylistically, you can tell the age of buildings. But a lot of... Interesting thing is a lot of buildings have been added to and changed and altered enough that you really aren't sure. Some of the oldest buildings are probably unrecognizable now on this stretch. Mm-hmm. The building that juts out used to have in the night the what's it called? The store below?
The store Aritzia?
Aritzia. The upper floors of that used to be the Soviet Union's friendship office, which meant all the spies would hang out there during the Cold War period. If you look at the HMV store, I think a chunk of that's been rebuilt. But in fact, that's the very older type of building, like I said, an 1850s or 60s building. So you have a very large mix of different buildings in the area. It's now, this part is a Heritage Conservation District, which means they're trying to protect the older buildings. The intent of that district is actually to protect the economic vitality of the neighborhood, which is really tricky to do through planning. It just happens or it doesn't happen. So this is Franco's building.
Oh, great.
Sorry, we have...
That's this architect Harry Ponturini did this building, which is now the Foot Locker. very good new building. So there's a real an attempt with a lot of architects to try and do good infill. Mm-hmm. It's tricky to know what that. So there's good infill and bad infill.
I know. What are the characteristics of good infill in this area, would you say?
There's having some attempt to respect the context and the character of the area and see how you can actually contribute to that. And so the one we're looking at, the Foot Locker one, has a nice brick facade and it's kind of doing some interesting stuff. This is Eb Zeidler's office. This being what a street address would be.
315
Queen is Eb Zeidler's office, the guy who's designed Ontario Place and Eaton Centre, and so it's actually really nice to have an office on the street.
We're just approaching Queen and John, the what was formerly known as the Chum Building, which is now owned by CTV, and originally it was called the Wesley Building, terracotta, built just after the turn of the century. It's actually a really kind of unique use of terracotta. They were actually at that time still trying to figure out how to use the material as a building face, as a kind of veneer. The building's a kind of steel structure with the terracotta as kind of units, as pieces that are just kind of hung off the steel.
And the steel rusts.
It starts to jack and it puts pressure on the terracotta. So actually we've done quite a bit of work on this building over the last 10 years or so. And there's actually been quite a bit of work on it over the last 30, 40 years with this kind of ongoing issue.
It was a religious book depository for the, so they made Bibles and things in there. So the detailing is all Gothic, intentionally to reference the church. And so it's, and you'll see little figures reading books and things like that if you look up at it. So it's all kind of book related and scholarly and kind of religious. So it's funny now, it's kind of a place of loud music. So that's an interesting building.
Do these forms in the circle some? What is this?
Those are all Gothic. They're all Gothic motifs. So it's pretty straight, simple. In other circumstances, we call collegiate Gothic. They were building lots of colleges at the time, and they have a lot of that kind of. It meant scholarly, academic, but it was Gothic. Quatrefoils and things that are Gothic motifs. This interesting building across the street, it's a little market. It's called the St. Patrick's Market. And that building that's there now isn't that old. But what happened when the city was first built as a series of wards, they all had names like St. Lawrence, St. Patrick, St. Andrew, St. David, all these ward names. And every ward had its own market. So we have St. Lawrence Market still as an example. This was the north side of Queen was called St. Patrick's and the south side of Queen was called St. Andrew's. And so this is the market that got built. And again, the north side of Queen was privately owned land. It was owned by the family that owned the Grange. And so to make money, they built their own market and they owned it and they just ran it as their market. But it was that's the Bolton family. They were, unlike the Baldwin family were very left-wing, progressive folks, and the Bolton family owned the Grange were really right-wing rednecks. They were establishment characters, and so different groups meant different things. But they gave their big chunk of their park lot away to build the Archive of Ontario. So they had a good redeeming feature. But the St. Andrew's Market was a fantastic market, and it burned down, and all that's left is just a little bit of a park called the St. Andrew's Playground, which is on Adelaide, right? So it'd be interesting to think, we're now coming back to the idea there might be local markets, but that was historically the way things had actually worked in Toronto.
In the deep. So now we're carrying on towards McCall.
Yeah. Honda McCall and
so I guess we might as well continue along to these strange buildings. buildings like Campbell House and possibly even past the City Hall.
Okay.
Does that suit everyone?
Yes. How far do you want to?
Well, how much time do you have?
About an hour?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
okay.
Just keep going until it seems right, or we don't have the time.
No, that sounds good.
There's a lot of different eras and vernaculars going on the north side, looking here over Scotiabank to those apartment buildings.
Yeah. Well, and you can also look up to OCAD.
Yeah, right.
And again, here you get this weird situation where McCall jogs onto Duncan, and that's because they were all laid out at different times. So Duncan was laid out, and that was the end of the city, and this was farmland north of Queen. And then when they gradually developed those streets, not all of them could align because all kinds of stuff had been built in the way over the early part of the 19th century. And so you get these weird jogs in the... We always think of Toronto just being a straight grid, but in fact it has all these weird disjunctions, and there's always a reason for every one of them. Again, lots of different periods of development in the city, different types of buildings. The Toronto Fire didn't come, well, there were actually quite a few Toronto fires. There was a fire in the 1840s that was in the East End. There was a fire 1905-ish or so in the around Bay Street. But this area just had some localized fires, nothing gigantic. But so you do actually get, that's why when you walk past some of these buildings, some of the two-story buildings, especially ones with pitched roofs, are actually very old. We just don't actually know how old they are. No one's actually paid any attention to them. And then you get amazing buildings. If you look at, say, the Rex, okay, very cool building, because you can look at it and you can sort of see that it was a two-story building. See, and it's actually had a... And you can see the different colored bricks made a little cornice.
Yeah.
And then it probably had a pitched roof, and they took the pitched roof off and they've added another floor on top with a new parapet, and you can see all kinds of repairs to it. And you can see that the lintels, the stone over the windows, is different on the second floor than on the third floor. Yeah. So any of these buildings you can look at for quite a while. You can read them as having had all kinds of changes. And so that the Rex is a perfect example, because you're getting some like a little layer cake of changes, because the ground floor is pretty modern. And the brick on the second floor, I bet you that's 1850s or so. What do you think, Philip? Yeah.
It's got a Flemish bond on it.
It's got, yeah.
That was pretty impressive.
See, even the brick pattern's
that's
different.
The way it's laid, eh?
Yeah.
So you'll get the one course of stretcher, and then immediately above that you'll get a stretcher header, and the header are the kind of short bricks, and the stretchers are the kind of longer bricks, and so when you get that alternating every course like that, that's called a Flemish bond. As opposed to like a kind of common bond, which is kind of what we've got up top there, actually. Yeah. Where it's, for the most part, it's just stretcher.
So this little guy, the Rex Hotel, would have started off as two Georgian houses. So it's two houses, each with two windows per second floor, and with a pitched roof, all that sort of stuff. And it's completely changed over time. It started off as little houses. They would have had little shops on the ground floor. The guy who ran the shop probably lived on the second floor. That's 150 years ago. So they all have a very interesting life to them. And some of them you can't even figure, like the one that's across the street on the other side of St. Patrick and on the north west corner of St. Patrick and Queen. You can't really tell much about that because it's got this siding on it. So if you actually took the siding off, you might find a very interesting building. The mansard roof on top may have been added later or maybe part of the original building. We don't know.
Sorry, what did you call the roof?
That's a mansard roof. It's a kind of 1870s or so stylistic deal that's a bit like mansard. Mansard was an architect of 100 years earlier from France. But it's a style to make it a Second Empire building, which was popular. So you can look up and down the street, and you can see Edwardian buildings, Second Empire buildings, Georgian buildings, 1950s buildings. And you get this kind of amazing blend of all these different things, which makes it an incredibly rich environment. And the more you know about it, the richer the kind of thing comes. And it's you could walk up and down the stretch, and you can continue to learn more and more and more every time you walk the street. Is this okay?
This is great. Yeah.
Okay. So if you look at this, the new building that's just gone up, which includes courtrooms, it's 180 Queen. It's got a fantastic restaurant at Nota Bene, one of the best restaurants in the city. It's a modern building, and I think it's designed by a very well-respected firm. But I'd say I have real problems with the scale of this building in relation to the rest of the street. Uh-huh. And we were just looking at, you know, the Rex, and it's got all this texture and character, and you can talk about each floor being a little different and telling you something else. This building reads, unfortunately, it lacks the scale, it lacks the gesture, and it lacks the detail to really catch your eye much. So your eye all of a sudden just goes, whoa, you know, onto the next thing. What a good urban environment needs lots of texture. And this building doesn't really give you much of that. And it seems as if the scale is all based on how big the model was when it was made. It's kind of it just went from early design development into getting built. Philip, do you want to get sued as well?
I would agree, and not to go too far with it, but I do think it's a building that feels a little misplaced on Queen Street with the scale and character that you have in this area, especially, you know, one of the oldest buildings in Toronto, Campbell House, right beside it. I think that's just kind of, I think that does speak to some things that we're gonna.
Yeah, my experience of walking and biking down this street, it always seems to mark the transition point from the kind of street pedestrian activity, that western part of Queen into the business.
Well, the argument was being made that this is like a University Avenue building. And maybe that is possibly the case, but I think Queen Street should have been the stronger reference. So
here we have this CIBC building with its massive columns.
Yeah. Well, this. This is a fantastic little bank building. The CIBC on the south side, 205 Queen. I forget the age of this building, and I forget the architect too, but it's a fantastically well-made little building. And in the 19th century, if you were fairly educated, you could use architectural styles to tell you about the building and the character of the building. So it was totally appropriate that this was a Greek Revival building, and the fluted columns and the Doric nature of them was totally what you'd have for a bank. So you wouldn't have that for a theater. Because it should be more light and elegant. So these kind of stubby columns were meant to be about security and about being very stable and basic, kind of things you'd have for a bank. So there's all kind of meaning built into the stylistic references in the building. And it's really nice stonework.
So Campbell House, which you mentioned, off across the street on the north side, was moved to this site in 1972, I think, from a place further east. What was it? Had an axial view of the lake.
Yeah.
Over in Old York, right?
Yeah, and it's kind of too bad that it got moved, but at the time they thought it might just get demolished, so that would have even been worse. And it got moved here because it was basically the first, it was the chief lawyer for Upper Canada.
And it met the Boy Scouts.
And so it was moved by the Law Society. And the Law Society, of course, run Osgoode Hall.
Right.
He was an interesting guy. And he was the most colorful of the legal figures from early Toronto. The house itself is 1820s, so that's about as early as you get for buildings in the city. The Grange is earlier at the Arc of Ontario, and the Fort York buildings are earlier, but there's not a lot of early, it's very little is left of that kind of early Georgian Toronto.
Okay, so crossing University now on the way to the Opera House.
I've never seen these external blinds.
It's good, eh?
Yeah, it is.
So we could stop here for a sec, because University Avenue is another weird street, and it was called University Avenue because it was actually an avenue that started at Queen and went to the university, and it was a private gated road, tree-lined gated road that was to go to the university, and it stayed like that from the 1820s till the 1890s, and it was actually two streets. So there was a public street beside it that the citizens could use, and then the rest of it was for the university. And it was only in the 20th century that the two roads got put together. And the university never built on the spot to the north because they'd started something called King's College. And King's College was going to be kind of the right-wing establishment college. It was directly connected to the royal family in England and all that sort of stuff. People like Robert Baldwin opposed, said, well, Canadians should have their own government and that sort of thing. They opposed setting up a college that was that strongly connected to England. And so they fought for years. The King's College never got built. It got partly built. They turned it into a lunatic asylum, and it was located right where the legislature is now. And then Robert Baldwin and his friends built University College, which then was non-denominational, was not connected to the Church of England or connected to the royal family. So we have all these kind of fights that are still kind of happening. So it's interesting that the space was then taken over by the legislature in the 1890s as the top of University Avenue. And this whole thing we see now was only done in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s.
But this,
the wide boulevard and the fact you have tall buildings around it. So University Avenue as it sits now is something quite different than it had been through most of the 19th century. But it was supposed to be, and it's actually the only street in the city that there's been any real urban design input on. That's actually a designed street, and now people don't like it too much. Like they think it's the middle intersection doesn't work for the boulevard doesn't work very well.
Yeah, well, it's a strange space to come and rest or have your lunch. I would think with the cars flying past on either side of you.
Yeah.
We were talking before about the university being a bit of a barrier psychologically too, because it's such a gulf, you know, to have to cross it.
Yeah.
As a pedestrian or a cyclist.
Yeah, it's quite a dash usually to get all the way across in one line.
Well, there's some big pushes to kind of redesign it periodically. Everyone keeps saying, well, could they do other things? But it's got a lot of infrastructure in it, so it's hard to move trees around. But they have moved all those monuments on a period, like all the center line doesn't align with the Queen's Park directly, so they actually they've moved it around.
So moving east again, past the new building for the Performing Arts on the south and the Osgoode Hall on the north side.
So Osgoode Hall is a great building. It was actually built as a series of buildings. They built the wings first, the pavilions on the corners, on the edges, and they date from the 1830s. And then the center part was added, and the center part used to look different and got changed again and again and again, but the center part dates from the 1870s or so, and it's one of the best buildings in the city. I don't know if you can actually wander in there And you can go past all the security guard stuff, and you can go and see a fantastic library. It's on the second floor.
Oh, yeah.
Go in and have a look. The gates were designed to keep livestock out of the gardens, because that was, even in the 1890s, there was still livestock wandering around on the streets. And so the entrances are especially made so you can't fit a cow through them.
I mean, this is the strangest part of Queen Street to me. I mean, University is a bit of a jaunt, right? But, you know, the south side of Queen Street here, actually, even along the north face of the Performing Arts Center there, where just that kind of activity, the commercial retail, it just kind of drops off. You come over here with the Sheridan kind of driveways and a kind of blank wall that faces City Hall, which is actually kind of disappointing, because, you know, of all the civic spaces in the city, City Hall as a kind of open square, and Toronto's got so few open squares, you'd think that this would be the opportunity to kind of, that we all kind of come together and we could all kind of make an address onto this square as a civic space, but it's not handled like that in any kind of way. I mean, we do just have very kind of limited addresses onto the square, and then what's furthermore, we have this kind of ring. It's a bit of a barrier around the square in and of itself, you know, with the kind of elevated walkway that wraps it as a kind of design piece. I'm not sure it was ever fully realized, or maybe, Michael, I mean, maybe you can correct me on this, but it's just, is it just the fact that it's not used? I mean, where does it take you? What does it connect you to?
Well, there's a whole bunch of things there. One is that the little elevated walkway around Nathan Fellow Square was intended to be, in the 1960s and 70s, people talked about pedestrian systems that were raised above traffic, and they're called plus 15 systems. You go to Calgary, Calgary's got lots of them. So that's the only part of a plus 15 system that exists in the city, except there's a little bit at the Royal Bank Plaza near Union Station. And they just don't have the rest of the system. We went underground instead. But that's partly what that is, and it goes over to this building, the Sheridan Center, the little bridge crosses, and it was supposed to go all the way downtown. The Sheridan Center was designed by the same group of architects as the City Hall, the new City Hall. So there was an intent that they'd actually work really well together. But unfortunately, the Sheridan Center at grade level is kind of shut down, and it's really uninteresting. I still think it's a fantastic building, and all we need to do is open it up and get it connecting through. You can actually see it as, it's kind of a block between City Hall and the business district to the south. And then we've got Old City Hall and New City Hall. They're kind of fun buildings to think of typologically, because New City Hall is round and it's got something in the middle. Old City Hall is square and it's got a courtyard in the middle. So they're kind of a little obverse. They're little different kind of buildings. There's a real hope that the courthouses will move out in 2016 out of the Old City Hall, and maybe we'll have it back as a civic building again.
Now, what can you tell us about the architecture of City Hall here, and perhaps the changes that are going to happen to this site?
Well, New City Hall was the last of Ravel's buildings. He died during construction, and he was a Finnish architect. This is probably his major piece of work. It was won as a design competition, which was a really important deal, because it actually made people got people interested in architecture. It was wildly popular at the time. The building that had been designed earlier just got moved up to St. Clair, got built as a building on St. Clair. But so this this building was very well respected by the community. Everyone thought it was wonderful, but it was very interesting to have a time when people would think modern architecture is wonderful. We just are all doubtful about it now, right? So. But the council chambers in the middle, it had an observatory at the top. Ravel wanted a bar up there, and that just never happened. The square, I think, was intended to be a very public place. It was a part of an urban renewal scheme, because it actually replaced a lot of what had been called the ward, which was a rougher part of the city. We think now differently about urban renewal, but this is a good thing to happen. It's a fantastic building, but it hasn't had any really good looking after for 40 years. So there is a scheme now to regenerate the square, to really revitalize pieces of it and make it work better. And that's in process. So the green roof opens in a couple of days or something. So whenever people are listening to this now, they can go up and maybe see the green roof, right?
The
green roof is going to be on the podium level. And historically, see, a lot of things, because Revel died and the budget was cut, there are all kinds of things that didn't get built the way he wanted them to get built. Originally, the council chamber was supposed to be free-floating, but if you go in the lobby now, you'll see there's a big column there. They couldn't figure out how to engineer the free-floating podium, council chamber. On the second floor, you go up a huge ramp out of the courtyard, and you're supposed to go up there, and that's where dignitaries would drive their limousines. Nobody's ever driven their limousine up there, and there's no kind of reception for them, so that's part of what the work is happening now, that podium level become more public. What else? The bar never happened on the roof. So there's all kinds of things that could have happened and should happen, and they will happen.
I think if you get... I was up in... I think this is the Thompson building here.
Yeah, yeah.
That contains Tim Hortons.
Yeah, with the Tim Hortons, there's a great view, if you get up here, of that green roof right now.
Oh, yeah.
And it's pretty spectacular.
We can talk a little bit about Old City Hall.
Building, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Richardsonian Romanesque, and there was an architect, Richardson, that's why it's named after, that's his style. He's an American architect. There's almost an identical building in New York State. So it was a very popular style, courthouse and city hall. The style's meant to be, like they were in the 19th century, it was very revival, like you actually revive the style, you do a neoclassical building or a neo-Georgian building. So, but in this case, Romanesque, this Richardsonian Romanesque stuff allows you to be quite experimental. You could do lots of very interesting stuff that never actually had existed before. So it was regarded as a very adventurous, very robust kind of style. The architect, E.J. Lennox, he basically could do any style you wanted. So he did Casa Loma, was another one of his buildings. So he just did anything and did them quite well. He had huge fights over building this building. He fought a lot with the city over budgets. And he eventually had his little face is carved as one of the gargoyles. His name, his initials and name are in the cornice. So he had a lot of fun with the building. And then it was renovated. There's quite a bit of renovations happened in the last decade or so. And there are gargoyles that have been replaced up on the bell tower that had disappeared about 40 or 50 years ago. They were been put back.
Oh, yeah.
The originals gone missing entirely, just photographic evidence that they'd been there. I believe one of the faces of one of the gargoyles is the restoration architect who worked on the project. So it's a style that continues.
Would they have been functioning gargoyles or just decorative?
They're decorative, yeah, because there's no rainwater coming out there.
Yeah, you wouldn't want it spitting onto the street either, I suppose.
No. I don't know what else to tell you about that building. It's a fantastic building. And actually, when it was built, well, there's a couple things. It's the third city hall for the City of Toronto, this one, the old city hall. It's the third one, because the earlier ones are where St. Lawrence Market is. And if you actually look at the St. Lawrence Market building, part of the old city hall is incorporated into that. So we look at the front street facade of that. And everything kind of moved north with all the trains coming into the south part of the city. So City Hall moved up here to be at the top of Bay Street. And it got built in the 1890s. By about 1920, they were saying it was old and obsolete, and they had to get rid of it. And at one point when they were building the Eaton Center proposed they keep the bell tower, but that was it. They'd knock the rest of it down and build the rest of the Eaton Center onto this site. And it started to be a big fight with people sort of saying, well, wait a minute, this is actually a very cool building. And a bunch of guerrilla preservationist people came out and washed it one night because it was just filthy dirty. And so they washed it to show how clean and nice it would look if it got cleaned. And that started a whole big movement for people saying, well, maybe we should keep this building.
Amazing. Okay, so walking east again.
Where should we carry on from here?
We should probably, maybe we should head back and around. Can we do that? Or do you want to keep going? Where do you want to go?
Keep going.
I wouldn't mind entering the business district.
Okay.
And talking about some skyscrapers.
Okay.
Does that suit you?
Sure, sure.
Yep. So that would mean maybe turning right at Bay, I guess.
Okay.
I was reading that in the late 1700s, people called this street Bear.
Bear Street.
Bear Street, that's right.
Because there was a bear that was chased away. That was hanging around and became known as Bear Street.
Well, that's quite possible because I think people forget how quickly change happens, and people don't realize that the city's quite a young city, and change has been dramatic. And when people worry about change happening, it's like, well, get over it, because there's a huge amount of change that occurs. So if we walk down Bay Street. Is it still working okay?
Yep, looks good.
Okay. If you walk down Bay Street, this is called the Bay Street Canyon because of the heights of the buildings around the piece.
Did it start to rise up?
Well, it started to rise up because there was a fire here in 1905, and everything burned down. And that meant, and it was centered on Bay Street, so that meant that there was all this opportunity to build new. And so at that period, they started just building up on this section. And you've got to think, like, we're entering into an area of office buildings, but in, say, something like 1850, there was no such building type as an office building. There was no such thing. And so it's a new typology. And Toronto went through a whole phase very aggressively. It was kind of like Chicago. It went through a phase of building tall buildings in the early part of the 20th century, latter part of the 19th century. We passed a site. There had been a building on Bay Street called the Temple Building, which was one of the tallest buildings in the city for a long time. It was demolished, 50 or so years ago. But if we went over a little further, like King and Bay, there's a whole series of buildings that were for some time the tallest building in the empire, in the British Empire. And they all competed with each other. And the idea, each bank wanted to be taller than any other bank.
Each bank wanted to be
taller than any other bank.
It's kind of like condo towers right now.
It's like condo towers, yeah. Now we're at the corner of Temperance and Bay. And here you see, there's just been the Bay Adelaide Center's just been finished or almost finished. And you can see on the corner, we didn't work on this, but on the corner, there's a facade of an older bank building attached to, very tightly attached to, a new tower. Mm-hmm. And there's pros and cons. People argue, is this a good thing to do, not a good thing? But I don't have an answer for that. Everyone has to make up their own mind about that. But I think it would be a shame to kind of lose the texture and character of the older building. It's a shame that the newer buildings can't provide that character and texture all on their own. This is Temperance Street. Again, you get like all this, all these things, everything can give you some kind of broader reference of a history. So Temperance Street was owned by Jesse Ketchum, and he was a temperance guy, so you couldn't, until maybe the last couple years, have a liquor license on Temperance Street.
So until when did you say?
Just maybe a decade ago.
Wow.
Do you know anything about this building that's under construction here on the opposite corner from the Bay Adelaide Center?
This is the Trump Tower, and it's being designed by Zeidler, and we just walked past his office on Queen Street. I think the strip of turquoise on the corner is supposed to light up and go all the way up and down, and I think that's a public art component piece that's designed as part of the tower.
Wasn't there a James Turrell
Is that it?
It could be.
Yeah. There's public art on this guy, which is actually really cool too, which is the Bay Adelaide Center. You have to go down that way to see it, but it's pretty nice. So a lot of the major towers are required by the city agreements to provide a public art component, which is 1% of the construction cost of the building. And some of these buildings that can be pretty enormous.
Yeah. Bay Adelaide Center, there used to be a building there called the Stump, is that right?
Well, the Stump was the elevator shaft that had been started to build a new tower, and it was just the concrete stump. And the whole building just stopped at that point, never got finished. So that was the...
Oh, okay, right.
So the stump is gone, but it was a big deal. Is this going okay? So
yeah. It's interesting how the... When the scale of the buildings change, the scale of the components change too, right? And you get these huge, huge stones.
Yeah. Well, also, you get, if you, in these bank buildings, they were very much for show, so that they tried to, you know, convince you that the bank was doing well by showing itself off a lot. If you go in, a lot of them have fantastic banking halls, like really great banking halls.
You know, there's also something that's happened. I don't know, if you, just from where we were on Queen Street there walking south, the kind of typologies of buildings. You know, it's, at some point, and it's probably, you know, Chicago was going through similar things, but at some point it switched from kind of heavy mass exterior walls. That's where all your kind of structures located in a building. And, you know, with steel being used quite a bit, sort of changed how these buildings were being constructed. So all of a sudden you started getting, you know, much taller buildings, and they could go greater heights without kind of relying on just kind of simple mass of a structure around the exterior of the buildings.
Yeah,
so I won. So steel would have come in the late
1800s?
Yeah. Late 1800s, early century.
Well, it's technology like steel construction and elevators and revolving doors. All these things were able, you could then build tall buildings and get them to work. So when the technology came in, the technology was like, Toronto was kind of 20 or so years behind Chicago. Chicago was very advanced, but Toronto was doing quite well. If you look, like right now we're right across from something called the National Club, which just has a little railing says NC. The National Club was a pro-Canadian, anti-American, or maybe it's the other way around, I'm not sure. But a group still is. They were able to sell their air rights for their club to Scotia Plaza when it built. And so if you actually go into the National Club now, they have their own private entrance into the Scotia Plaza. So all these buildings are interconnected, and they're all about stacks of money. And so Bay Street's kind of Canada's Wall Street, for sure. It has that kind of character to it. And Bay and King... is known by the bankers as center ice. So the whole idea is you've got to have your bank as close to center ice as possible. So all the banks try to collect there. I used a hockey analogy.
That was great, Michael. I didn't expect that from you.
That's right. So the Bank of Montreal building, which everyone I think can recognize from quite far away, at one point one of the tallest, but it's been clad in Carrara marble. And recently some of the fasteners behind the backup have been failing. And so there's a maintenance program that's on right now where they're replacing those fasteners bit by bit, and these large slabs of Carrara marble are coming down. Now I can't remember what they're actually replacing, if it's precast units or if it's thicker Carrara marble.
It's fritted glass. So they're going to take all the marble off and replace it with fritted glass. So it's glass with an etching to it, and the etching will give it kind of the appearance of this, but it won't be the marble anymore. They didn't realize when they built this building that marble of this, that thin marble, might actually move a little bit. So it's a, there you go. So now this is a building by Edward Durell Stone, who's a big, it's the Bank of Montreal, what's it called? First Canadian Place. So it's one of the, it's the Bank of Montreal's push to be on the corner on this site. So they demolished the earlier Globe and Mail building that was here. And all of these buildings that started out, all these big bank buildings that started out as with Mises' idea, you'd have a big plaza and you'd build a tower at the back. And the city's planners have fought with everyone about that to try to say, let's reduce these plazas because they're not really doing very much. So Edward Earl Stone was kind of forced to build a podium to take over the plaza area. Bank of Nova Scotia was told they'd actually have to keep their original building. So when they built the new tower, they retained their existing building on the corner, the Bank of Nova Scotia building, which was an earlier 1940s building, which is very nice. So you get a kind of whole morphing of the tower and plaza to being these more urban buildings in this area. The other two, well, so you get the Edward Durrell Stone's building, which is Scotia Plaza. You get Mies van der Rohe's TD Centre. You get I.M. Pei's CIBC Commerce Court building. And then the Scotia Plaza was the first actually designed by Canadians. So it was designed by Webb Zarafa.
What would you call this, international style?
This the earlier Bank of Nova Scotia building, it actually has a really interesting history. It was first designed before the war by an architect named John Lyle. And John Lyle was an incredible, very interesting architect who worked on Union Station, for example. But he died, and they never built the building because of the war. And so when it got built later, it was a stripped-down Art Deco building.
Right.
So what you'd actually call it, I don't know exactly. But it's got some very interesting, it's got some really good, interesting carved work both inside and outside.
Little references to columns to those capitals.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a... I don't know what exactly... it got a lot of criticism for being stripped down from its original, from the earlier design. But it's actually a spectacular building.
When you mentioned the Mies van der Rohe influence on building design around here, was that directly related to the building of TD Plaza, or was that just something that was?
Yeah, no, because Mies was a major influence. And he basically demolished the much earlier classical bank building that was on this corner. Mies demolished a lot of really great buildings. He built this group, the TD Center, and had a really big effect on people. And it meant that Toronto was actually kind of modern. And they actually got that very much. And this grouping of buildings, the TD Center, may in fact be Mies' best collection of buildings now. Like they're very well maintained, very important group, and they've been added to. There's been other buildings added overall. But Mies' idea was he wasn't going to use the plus 15 system that's around City Hall. He was actually going to use the underground, and so the commercial stuff would go underground. The ground level was for pedestrians, so the ground level was for people, that's the reason for creating these big plazas. So everyone else tried to do that, but the next one was I.M. Pei, and he decided he was the Commerce Court buildings, and they're CIBC, and they're very interesting buildings. He decided there's a special metal used in the cladding developed specially for the building, but they decided that they'd keep the original building, the original bank building, CIBC building. And if you look at across the street, we're at King and Bay now, if you look across the street, the face of the old building, which has got a nice portal entrance, that's all by Mies, or by I.M. Pei. It's all by I.M. Pei because that was originally a party wall building. It had another building smacked up against it.
Oh, yeah.
So they recreated the new face of the building to make it freestanding.
So is that whole face?
That whole face is new. The stonework, so
up to the cornice.
So there was and the cornice. So very thoughtful kind of connecting of different buildings. And then you look on the other corner where the Bank of Nova Scotia is. You can barely see the new tower, the Scotia Plaza, because it's keeping so much of the original bank building, and it takes up most of the block. But on every corner, you're having a hard time finding the rest of it. And the same, you now see the downtown, all these office buildings have this whole mix of being urban, and they often incorporate other stuff. We won't go down as far, but if you go down to BCE Place, there's a whole link of old and new buildings all interconnected that make the thing work as one piece. But this neighborhood, you can call it the downtown core, has gone from a block that might have 60 or 70 little individual lots with little buildings with different owners all facing the street with stuff in a laneway at the back, have gone back to now there's maybe per block maybe two or three owners at most, and it's all one big building. And you don't actually connect it by the street edge, you may connect by the subway or in lots of different, it's a very different urban form than it was 100 years ago. Should we go this way?
Actually, there's remnants of that, Michael. Just if we,
bits and pieces, yeah.
Yeah, head west along King Street.
We can sort of wrap it up whenever you feel. We don't have to get back to YYZ.
Oh, you don't? Okay, well, because we parked near there, so we're going to kind of walk back that way. Is this what you're looking for, you think?
Yeah.
Okay.
They're actually giving away these large slabs of marble right now.
Yeah. Really?
For artists.
We're going to be actually using some of them in washrooms at the Don Valley Brickworks, the Evergreen Project, for their washroom counters. So.
Yeah, you can see right in behind right now what's behind that marble. And this is not the same as the other surface that was behind. That was poured concrete, I think. And this is what?
Like some kind of insulation panel.
Oh,
behind.
Right.
There's their mock-up for the fritted panels. Well, that won't be on the tour.
This is the glass. So we're looking at the looking north towards the First Canadian Place, the south facade, and there's these samples of the etched glass textured glass.
It's called fritted glass. Yeah.
So that doesn't look much the same, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Maybe those are failed samples. That won't work.
Right. So by the time, I guess they'll be doing this for quite a while, a year or so.
Oh, it's going to take a while. Well, yeah. I don't know.
So by the time people listen to this recording, it'll probably still be going on.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing scaffolding.
Yeah, it's actually quite amazing.
Yeah.
Where my friend Al's art installation used to be. And remember those two big chairs, oversized chairs?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think they were
big walls, yeah. Steel walls,
They took it down to do some kind of new maintenance or something like that to the site and then just decided to leave it down.
Do you want it to go back up?
I'm fond of it.
Okay. See what we can do.
Put it back.
So actually, when you look at the TD Center, two of the towers were by Mies and the others that weren't, and so they've all been added. Others have been added later, and they've been added kind of in the style of Mies, because I think the tenants were all going, well, I want to be in one of the original towers. So there's a fair amount of repetition. They're now going through, all the TD Center is all single glazed. So they're now going through a process of double glazing all the glass and stuff.
Can you differentiate the Mies from the others?
Yeah, well, yes, you can. And it's subtle, but this one, for example, isn't one of the Mies. The Royal Trust Tower.
Well, that's glass.
So we're now walking west. We're getting close to York Street. And I guess, one thing, you can look up York Street and you'll see Osgoode Hall. And you'll see one of the wings of Osgoode Hall on the focal point of the view terminus of the street. And historically, it used to be that pretty much every major building in the city sat at the end of a view corridor of a street looking towards the lake. And so out of the trees, you can see York Street has, you'll see it past the trees, has Osgoode Hall. Just the way Bay Street has the old City Hall, or University Avenue has the legislature. And that was at a time when you could see the lake, but there's been about a kilometer of lake fill.
Yeah, right. So right now we would be very close to the lake shore.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So years ago.
So how many of these tours are you doing?
Four, I think.
Four?
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yeah, we're kind of sort of going in the four cardinal directions.
Okay, okay.
You're going up sort of up Spadina and that
who's,
area.
Who's
too,
doing the other ones?
That's with Scott and Flav.
So. Okay, yeah, yeah, that'd be good.
We're going with Margaret Briegman and James Brown. Down to the lakeshore.
Oh, good, okay.
Margaret's a transportation engineer.
Yeah, yeah.
And some friends, Deborah Wang and Will Ellsworthy, who are both trained in architecture.
Oh, great, okay.
They get going through west through the residential area, west of Spadina there.
Okay. Well, I can do another little bit up here because we're walking along King.
Yeah, so walking west on King just past University.
Yeah.
Just west of University.
So we're coming close to St. Andrew's Church and Roy Thompson Hall. And this is an area that's, again, changed dramatically. So if you want to try and picture different periods of time, before Roy Thompson Hall was built, that would have all been turned into railway tracks and railway storage yards and things like that. So very industrial. But if you put it back even earlier in Toronto's history, we were in a part of the town called the New Town.
Yeah.
And there was a little creek that ran through here that made it really hard to build on New Town and this part of New Town. And so they made three major public squares. And the square that's the site of Metro Hall and Roy Thompson Hall, whereas where the Lieutenant Governor had a mansion, and so the whole block was just his mansion and a big estate, and that's where they'd have all kinds of fancy parties. But what we see now is just that the fact that it was one big estate meant that it could actually be assembled, and that's why you have the assembly of Metro Hall and Roy Thompson Hall on that one big piece of land. South of that, on the block where the CBC is and those other buildings, was where the Legislature for Canada was. So it was where the Parliament buildings were. And they were there from the 1830s until the 1850s or so, when the legislature got moved to Montreal. And so that was a major piece of land. And then north, on this block on the north side of King, was where Upper Canada College was. And so there are all these major kind of institutions in the downtown core. There's actually a little building on Duncan, just on the north end of this block. That's the boarding house for Upper Canada College. So that stuff is still kind of, there's little remnants of it here. But when Upper Canada College moved, it got all subdivided for warehouse uses related to the railways. And the only building that kind of stands out that's not a warehouse building is Roy Thompson Hall. And the Royal Alex Theatre on the north side of the street. And the Royal Alex Theatre is a pretty remarkable building. It's another building by this architect John Lyle, and it was not like the watered-down version that you see with the Bank of Montreal building. It was one of his better pieces, and it was done. He was a Canadian architect who was trained at the École des Beaux-Arts, so he was the first kind of really official important architect in the city, I think. Maybe I exaggerate a bit on that, I'm not sure. But the rest of the buildings are pretty much warehouse buildings. They're all, the whole bunch of them are painted white, and that's because the Mirvish family bought them and they thought they'd fix up the neighborhood. And they've actually held on to them for about 40 or 50 years.
Do you want to speak a little bit about the Royal Alexandra Theatre and the sort of classical
style? Well, the Royal Alex Theatre is very much an architect trained in Paris, the École des Beaux-Arts. In the 19th century, that's where any architect went to get trained, was in Paris. And so this is a very classical building of that period, and it actually has the little peaked slate roof that's called a mansard roof. And so again, this is the classy version of the shops we see on Queen Street that were kind of the more derivative, do it later kind of version. So the building's about the first part of the first decade of the 20th century. It had started to seriously fall apart, and it was Ed Mervish who bought it and has fixed it up, and he's also done similar things in London, England, and very strong promoter of both architecture and theater. So you have the mansard roof, you have all the classical details, including the pilasters with the Ionic columns and the swags, the decorative swags carved in stone.
Swags
are the kind of festooning of, they look like garlands or something like that, but it's all carved out of stone. So all of these motifs are classical in origin, but they go back to all kinds of things. For the Greeks, they were representative of trophies that they'd won, so they were kind of signs of success, la la la.
Animal sacrifice, I was reading.
Animals, yes, exactly, yeah. There are all kinds of gory references. They're flattened. They actually could be flattened Corinthian columns, but which would be appropriate for a theater. So you'd have a fancier kind of column. You wouldn't have a Doric column on a building like this. And it's got a carved, it's got a rusticated but a very nicely made coursed stone base. So it's all about refined detail. Everything's really the higher edge of refined details, which you wouldn't see. It's almost the opposite of the Old City Hall, which is all about rusticated, rough-looking, rough-hewn kind of material, intentionally very different. You could talk about the Old City Hall being masculine and this be a feminine style. They do that in the 19th century, talk about it like that. So Lyell was a very sophisticated guy. He also, if you look around some of his other buildings, as he went from this straight classicism, it was very much what he learned in school, to saying, well, he's a Canadian. And so he started to incorporate into his buildings, and they're all over the place. You'll see them. He carved little beavers. The Runnymede Library, if you take a look at his totem poles, a lot of the bank buildings, he did have little all kinds of Canadian motifs. He did a fantastic bank, the main Bank of Nova Scotia in Halifax, that's just covered with Canadian, like salmon and all kinds of things built in. So he tried to talk about what did a Canadian architecture mean. And a Canadian architecture meant you'd build that kind of stuff into your building.
Huh.
So, interesting guy.
And so you said that Mervish owns still these warehouse buildings?
Yeah, I think he still owns them all, or his son David. David had a very interesting gallery in one of these buildings for quite a while, and he's a fairly major collector of art. I think the idea was to try and brand the buildings. At the time, the city opposed Mervish actually operating these buildings. He wanted to put restaurants in the warehouses, and they said that they couldn't do that, and he'd have to demolish the upper parts of the buildings if he wanted to run restaurants. So he was in what was then a pretty tough part of the city, and the city wasn't all that cooperative or interested in having him here because it was all regarded as an area for urban renewal. But actually, if you step back into this area, you get into an area called the Kings, and this King Spadina and King Parliament, two different planning areas. And so these areas went into kind of total doldrums in the 1960s and 70s, and that's when Mervish started to buy up some of these buildings. And the city said, well, we don't really want you to buy them up. We want industry to stay downtown, so we don't want you to turn these things into restaurants and stuff like that. We actually want them to retain industrial uses. And that just didn't happen. Like, industry just moved elsewhere. And so at the time, the mayor, Barbara Hall, said, well, in fact, what we don't want to preserve is the character of this area, but we'll have a brand new zoning that doesn't exist anywhere else. You can basically do whatever you want as long as you retain the basic form of some of these buildings. And subsequent to that, there's been all kinds of development in the area. And some of it's gigantic. So this is the festival hall that's getting constructed here, which is... what's it called? North of King. Yeah. Yeah, it's called the Lightbox. And it's designed by the architects, KPMB, who happened to be in one of Mervish's buildings right on the other side of the corner in the Ellipse Whiteware Company. So KPMB's offices are there in the building. Their building is right next door. Just keep going? Okay, so... coming up to a stretch called Restaurant Row from John and King, and this is a kind of remnant bit of, just like you had on Queen Street, a lot of older buildings together, and they're buildings that date from the 1840s to the 1890s.